From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Soap and water. Have you ever thought so much about it? I know one man who's been contemplating these two ingredients for years.
Washing the dishes in a sink with clean, warm water is a luxury. If you've ever lived without clean running water or warm water, or even if you've ever camped in the wilderness, you already know this. It is also a task of order and of health and hygiene. The kitchen is an operating room, and although you may not always be the one operating, you are the one cleaning up after a kind of surgery. You have all the surfaces and all the equipment to scrub and make ready for the next use. You may be lucky enough to have a dishwasher. The dishwasher is the express train. But your kitchen sink, that's the local.
That's the one and only Peter Miller. A true individual, Peter owns an architecture and design bookshop in Seattle called Peter Miller Books. Fortunately for us, he's also a writer, and his latest book is a personal favorite. It's called How to Wash the Dishes. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm fine. This book is one of the most delightful things we have seen. Or not one of the most. This is the most delightful book we have seen so far this year.
Oh, Evan, keep it up. I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased you've read it. It's a great pleasure to write something, and it's a much greater pleasure to have somebody read it and like it.
So where do we begin? What is at the center of every scrubbing up?
I mean, really at the bottom center is the drain, is literally the ability of the sink to drain. But then at the center of as it actually goes is this bowl of soapy dishwater.
So we're talking about washing the dishes in a sink.
Yeah.
So instead of just washing each individual thing with a sponge and using up a huge amount of water.
And soap.
And soap. We start with a bowl of soapy water.
Mm-hmm.
But the object is to still have access to the drain and still have a little area that you can put things that are dirty.
Yes, and have a place to pre-rinse, have a place to see that the water's going out, have a place to, work on a sharp knife.
Because one of the main objects is to keep that bowl of soapy water as pristine as one can for as long as one can.
Yes, you may change it, four, five, six times if it's a complicated enough meal. But really, it's only strength until it becomes gray and weak, is that it delivers, a strong solution of soap and hot water, which you can then use to get, grease or olive oil or those kind of things off.
I always put a glug of vinegar in mine, too.
Oh, good for you. It's a really good idea.
So do you have a preference of a type of soap you use, liquid, crystal, or powder?
I use liquid. I've tried a million different kinds. I use Common Good right now because I think it's the best on the market. I think it cuts the best, and I think it doesn't have that terrible difficulty of a smell that sort of trails you. There are soaps on the market that advertise their smell, but if it's still on your hands when you're done, cleaning, it just seems like a terrible idea to me.
Do you like to have your soap out just in the container it came in, or do you like to decant?
You're stepping into my country. I love decanting. I love decanting milk because I hate all the information on the side of the cartons, and I also think you keep track of the milk better. I really love decanting soap because you can put it into something completely clear with a better pump, and you can see if you're running out.
So what do we go with for cleaning? A sponge or a dishcloth?
I've always used a sponge, but a couple of trips to visit my daughter in Stockholm, and, they would never use a sponge there because you can't clean it well enough for them. So they use a dishcloth, and it's probably converted me now to a dishcloth. I still love the natural sponge. I love how it feels. I love how it can get into a wine glass. But so can this dishcloth. And the Swedes and lots of other countries, the Danes and the Swedes, have come up with a sort of cellulose structure that's completely sustainable. If you want to clean it, you boil it in water for 2 minutes and then hang it up. They don't even put it in a washing machine. They simply boil the darn thing and then leave it to dry, and then it's completely free of bacteria. You know, because I do still love a natural sponge. If you do use a natural sponge, then you have the caution of having to make sure it doesn't sour on you, which it will do if you leave soap in it. And a wonderful friend of mine from Montana said to me, well, rinse it, rinse your natural sponge, which I thought was a brilliant detail. Then she said, rinse it in cold water, and that will kill the remaining bacteria, and it won't sour.
So when you say natural sponge, you're talking about the ones that come flat, and then...
Yeah, the ones that come flat, and as soon as the water comes in, they grow up. And I love them. But you have to be careful, because they are better at keeping bacteria. You have to, it's sort of like doing the dishes. You have to finish with them at the end of the meal. You have to rinse them. And then her suggestion to rinse them in cold water, I just thought was brilliant.
Could you talk about your love of dish towels?
Do you love dish towels?
Oh, I have so many.
Aren't they the greatest? Can't you talk about them?
It's so funny, because reading this little book, I saw so much of myself in it. And you realize how important a ritual it is that gets so little attention.
Right.
And yet it's something we do every day.
Every day. Every day. And it's always there, no matter how good your dishwasher is. There are always dishes. That's the bookmark that we put in the book, that there you'll always have Paris and you'll always have dishes. But that if I hold up any of the dish towels to you, you could tell me a story about them.
And you keep you have two different sets of dish towels.
Yeah, in truth, I probably have four, but let's say two. You have the one my wife, for example, won't let me use. You know, if I reach for it, she takes it back. And she loves them, and she doesn't want them doing that duty. So they're in the kitchen for, you know, the more elegant duties of drying, holding something slightly warm, but not for cooking. And then there's the dish towel that is just a jeep, just a little truck, and its job is to do whatever is necessary to get that meal on the table.
The very back of the book has a wonderful thought. You say, you will know your state of mind when you wash the dishes, your care or your impatience, your attention or your distraction. You will see yourself at that moment clearly.
Isn't it funny? You do, though. You know, people are so good about trying to learn every technique for how to cook from every culture and civilization. But there's not near that kind of attention to either the prep or to the finish of it. If I'm in my kitchen and a certain thing keeps coming back on the plate, I really start to wonder what was the error on my part, or what was the, they didn't like the broccoli.
Yeah, it tells you so much.
Yes. It's when I learned that if you really want to be successful serving squash, you have to serve less and let them come back.
Peter, once again, it's a delight. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Evan. Thanks. Bye.
Peter Miller's book is How to Wash the Dishes. It is an absolute joy. Parents everywhere are sitting on pins and needles, wondering if schools will be closing due to public health concerns. But how would it affect the millions of students who rely on school lunch every day? That's up next. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. One in six kids face hunger in America, and many rely on school meal programs. Last week, Los Angeles declared a state of emergency due to the coronavirus. As countries across the globe institute school closures, citing public health concerns, what does it mean for those students in America who have limited access to nutritious meals? We check in with food writer and child policy advocate Bettina Elias Siegel. Hi, Bettina.
Hi, Evan.
I know this is a dynamic story and statistics keep changing, but currently, how many counties have closed schools nationwide?
You know, the last time I checked, schools were closed in New Rochelle, in Washington State, and I believe in California, but that may have increased since I last looked, unfortunately.
Yeah, everything is in such flux. What has been the response to this issue?
Well, so it really is a very important issue. I think people don't always think about this, but, you know, 31 million kids eat lunch every day. About 15 million almost eat breakfast at school. And then a little over a million are actually eating supper at school after school. So of all of those numbers that I just cited, the majority of those kids are economically dependent on the meal. And so, of course, if their school closes for COVID-19 or any other reason, they are suddenly cut off from, you know, very critically needed nutrition. So it's a really important issue. And what I learned is that the USDA, it's not like they had never thought about this. They already have procedures in place for school closures for any reason. It could be a labor dispute or, you know, some unexpected repair or whatever. The problem is that the kind of contingency plan that they have, though it's, you know, better than no plan, isn't really going to get the job done in a widespread outbreak.
I understand that part of their feeding plan in a situation like this is an agenda of what is called congregate feeding, or providing that the meals have to be provided in a group setting, which just seems the opposite of what's needed for this. What are some of the alternatives?
So exactly right. So the way it works normally is, you know, your school or district has to close down. They still want to serve meals to these, you know, at-risk kids. And so what the USDA tells them to do is just shift over to what's called the Summer Food Service Program, the SFSP. And so as the name would imply, normally that's going on in the summer, and it's a way of keeping kids fed during the summer. And the reason why it has this advantage in an emergency is because it authorizes schools to serve the meals elsewhere, like at a library or churches or YMCAs or whatever. But just as you said, one of the provisions in the SFSP is that the children have to eat together in a congregate feeding setting. And as you point out, that's really probably not a great idea in a viral outbreak. So the good news on that is Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue already has said very clearly, we can and will waive that requirement for any school that or district that wants to ask for a waiver, or any state, I should say. So that's good news. We don't really have to worry about that. The problem is there's some other provisions in the SFSP that also, I think, could really hamstring, you know, districts and states as they're trying to feed kids during this crisis.
Like what?
Well, so the main one, there's one of those is also, I think, easily taken care of. Right now, districts have to be pre-approved to do this switching over to the SFSP in an emergency by their state. And once again, Sonny Perdue has said, don't worry about it. We'll let you waive that too. So that's great. But it's this third complication that he says he does not have statutory authority to fix. And what that is that the SFSP is only supposed to operate in high poverty areas. So in other words, your district has to shut down because of the labor dispute or whatever, you can serve those meals under the program only if you're serving a population where 50% or more of the kids in the area where you're serving the meals are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And so just to put it in perspective, let's say a much more affluent district has to shut down right now because of COVID-19. What if only 10% of their kids need that meal? You know, they don't need it any less, but now that district cannot, right now, under the current statutory terms, operate under the SFSP. So that's a big hurdle.
I understand that, as we were talking about you coming on the show, that already there are different things that Congress is working on.
Yeah, so that's the good news. This is such a fast-moving story, and that's great because it shows that Congress is being responsive. And I must say, it's really, you know, Secretary Sonny Perdue has made it very clear he wants to be feeding these kids in high, you know, outside these hard poverty areas, and wants to get this fixed. So Just hours before, our conversation now, the House has introduced the COVID-19 Child Nutrition Response Act. And in my very quick reading of the bill, it looks like it will overcome these red tape obstacles that we've just been talking about to really free up schools and districts to do what needs to be done to feed hungry kids.
So are they going to do like pickups since the congregating is such a no starter, or will they put the meals on school buses and the buses will just go through their route and drop the food off?
So I think there's no one answer to that question. I think a lot is going to be decided on a district by district basis. You know, it may be the case that you come pick up your meal. Some hunger advocates I talked to said it would be ideal if what you really could do is give a child a bunch of non-perishable meals, breakfast and lunches, 10 each, you know, to take home if there's going to be a 2-week closure, because you don't really want to encourage people to be leaving their homes, maybe getting on public transportation just to be picking up meals, you know, all the time. I should say another initiative that's going on right now in Congress, I don't know yet what the outcome will be, is a movement to try to increase families' SNAP benefits during this crisis. And SNAP is this sort of new name for what we used to call the food stamp program. And as your listeners may be aware, you know, President Trump and his administration have really been trying to restrict people's access to SNAP. And these representatives in Congress are saying, listen, now is not the time to implement these new, more restrictive rules. I think some of them would say we never should, but they certainly, you know, don't want them implemented now. And indeed, they're seeking an increase in SNAP benefits. And so the advantage there is then families just have more food dollars in their pocket to spend, you know, in the most sensible way possible.
Wow, what a mess.
It is. I mean, it's so interesting. These crises, you know, they come out of nowhere and they really expose, I think, so many fault lines in our society. Like you suddenly realize, well, if people, you know, can't take sick leave, they're, you know, likely to come into work sick. And this is another one of those fault lines. Our safety net, our social safety net for children in many cases is going on at school. And what happens when the school closes?
Well, Bettina, we're so glad that we have you to turn to keep us updated on these issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for, you know, shining a spotlight on this really important issue. I appreciate it.
That's Bettina Elias Siegel. We've been discussing the developing story of COVID-19 and the implications on the National School Lunch Program. It seems that every part of the food system has been impacted by the pandemic, and farming is no exception. Our market correspondent, Jillian Ferguson, is in Santa Monica this week reporting on the highs and lows of the fallout.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. Larry Kandarian has been a busy, busy man lately. He is the owner of Kandarian Organic Farms up in Los Osos. And Larry, your specialty is beans and grains.
Yes, beans, peas, grains, pollens, and herbs and spices.
So a lot of dried goods.
Everything is dried goods.
So have you seen a rise in sales of your beans this past week?
We have. It's not just been the past week, but probably the last month. There's been an increase, and I don't know. I attributed it earlier to the cold weather and people wanting to make beans in a warm soup, but it's continuing, and it's continuing at a huge rate. So as you can see, we have several of them that are sold out already. So much more than the grains. So there's a lot more interest in beans and the leguminous crops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have quite a number of beans on the table, probably 20 different varieties that we can see just here. Can you walk us through the different varieties?
Sure. So we do from A through R on the beans, and we start with the adzuki. Adzuki is Ayurvedically warming, and then the opposite of that is mung, which is Ayurvedically cooling. So you think mung bean, just put an L in front and call it a lung bean, and when you take a breath, you cool yourself. So that's the mnemonic device to remember what it is. I don't have any mung beans. We had a run on those recently, and I don't know why. It's hard to predict what's going to sell, but you know, there's not a trend that one thing sells. There's bubbles all over the place. So go from A through R, we end up with red silk, which we're out of today as well, and everything in between. And probably the easiest to talk about are the pinto, the flor de mayo, and the cranberry bean. Pinto is a very earthy bean, and then flor de mayo is less earthy and a little creamier, and then cranberry is the creamiest. So these very similar look, similar taste, less earthiness, more creamy right there.
I think many people are familiar with cranberry beans and pinto beans, but what are flor de mayo beans?
That literally in Spanish means flower of May, and they're typically blooming in May, and it's a bean that we would harvest in probably in July or August. It's like a pinto. They would all harvest about the same time, and it grows similarly. They're all Phaseolus, the same family, Phaseolus vulgaris. Some of these are different. These are vignas. These are warmer season beans. So the adzuki, mung, and the black eyes are vignas, where these other ones are Phaseolus.
Okay, and do you cook the different beans differently?
No, we cook them all the same. We soak them differently. If they're a big bean like the ayacotes, ayacote negro or the regular one, we do 1 cup to 6 cups of water. So 1 cup of beans to 6 cups of water, and then we use a little apple cider vinegar, which is Weston A. Price's method of getting rid of the phytic acid and the lectins that's in the skin. Phytic acid and lectins are both anti-nutrients, and phytic acid especially ties up calcium, magnesium, and iron. And so if you want to get all the calcium, magnesium, and iron that's available in these seeds or grains, then you soak with apple cider vinegar.
How much apple cider vinegar do you include?
We just use 1 tablespoon to about 7 cups of water, and including the grain or the bean.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you. My distinct pleasure.
That was Larry Kandarian. You can find Kandarian Organic Farms at a number of markets all over California and also online. We've been hearing a lot about how businesses, big and small, are struggling with the fallout of the coronavirus, and farmers are no exception. County Line Harvest is one of the growers who's been hit hard by the ripple effect, and I'm here to talk about it with Megan Strom. Megan, it's been a pretty crazy week, I think, for all of us, and you've encountered a lot of uncertainty. How is all this impacting your world?
It's been a challenging week. You know, the uncertainty is probably the biggest piece. We can deal with a drop in sales, we can try and tighten up labor, but not knowing how long this will last is really challenging. We do a lot of sales to distributors that are selling to caterers, that are selling to tech companies, and their cafeterias have completely shut down. So our sales are down about 70% this week.
70?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, we have food that we've invested money in starting back in August, September. So we bought the seed, we planted it, we've been weeding it, we've been watering it, and I have a crew of 40 people that are, you know, expecting to have work to pick it so that we can sell it. The customer still needs to eat. So what we're trying to figure out at this point is that, you know, how have habits changed and how can we get our food to people? I've reached out to, you know, a lot of our community, our chefs, our buyers to see if we can get more stuff on retail shelves, if we can get stuff to home, you know, people who are cooking at home. Farmers markets have been a godsend. You know, it's been amazing that our sales at markets are actually up. So, you know, people are coming out, they're supporting us, but how else can we as a community come together to support the small businesses?
What are some of the creative solutions that you've come up with?
So one thing we're considering is doing a CSA style box with a weekly delivery to different hubs in different neighborhoods. So I've been in talk with Botanica in Silver Lake, Lady and Larder in Mar Vista, and it's... You know, they could order online through our website for a mixed vegetable box and then pick it up at those restaurants.
Okay. And you mentioned the labor piece earlier in this. Do you have workers who are depending on you for a 40-hour work week?
Yeah, sometimes 60 hours. So, you know, it's a seasonal business. We work hard October through June, and then a lot of people take the summer off. So, you know, we're cutting back now to about 30 hours per week, so cutting hours by about half. But we have a real responsibility to our employees. A lot of them have been with us for over a decade, and they have, you know, multiple family members working with us. So we're just doing everything we can to keep our doors open and keep, you know, keep paying them and just keep growing food.
So you grow both in Petaluma and Thermal. What are the other farmers in your communities saying right now?
you know, the farmers that are selling to restaurants in the Bay Area are struggling. Again, just so much uncertainty. Hotel restaurants, you know, the business there is dropping. The tech campuses has been a real blow to a lot of us. You know, they've been so supportive of local farms. And so to have that business just go away completely has been awful. And I haven't gotten a chance to talk to too many farmers down here, but the chefs are optimistic, and that's been really great to hear today, is that, you know, people are still going out to eat, and I think the chefs that use quality ingredients and that there's a trust factor there with their customers, you know, that business is still going strong, and that will, you know, help get us through this.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for sharing with us, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Megan Strom, co-owner of County Line Harvest. She's here with a reminder of just how important it is to support our local farmers and how important the farmers market is to them. You can find County Line Harvest at the Saturday Pico Market, the Saturday Torrance Market, Sunday in Mar Vista, and here Wednesday in Santa Monica. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, what would your last supper be? For me, it would be rice, beans, a great chili, and really good tortillas. But for Jay Rayner, it's quite an elaborate feast. We'll hear all about it in a minute. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. So I have a question for you. What would your final meal be? Given their proximity to the best ingredients and most decadent dinners spanning the globe, the question has been posed to many chefs and food critics alike over the years. Jay Rayner, restaurant critic for The Observer, decided to approach the query with a retrospective of his life. Hi, Jay.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. How many times do you think you've been asked about your final meal?
Dozens, scores, maybe hundreds. So I do a lot of live shows in the UK, which I know American restaurant critics find shocking because that means I'm slightly less than anonymous. But there's always a question and answer element in these live shows. And it is a question that has been asked at almost every single show. You know, Jay, imagine you're on death row. What would your last meal be?
And you go through this process, as you tell it in the book, that is so thoughtful and thorough. Have you managed to come up with any answer before you embarked on this particular project?
No. What I did do was I wrote a set of chapter headings, foods that I thought might be important to me, knowing myself quite well, as I think I do. A couple of those fell by the wayside, and they fell by the wayside because I quickly realized that I didn't have necessarily an emotional connection to them. I like cheese. Cheese is a marvelous thing. We all love cheese, unless you're lactose intolerant. But I love cheese. But when I thought about cheese, I reckon I couldn't get a whole chapter out of it because I didn't have this emotional connection. Whereas when I started thinking about, for example, oysters and my relationship with my dear late mother who introduced me to eating oysters and the joys of them, suddenly I realized there was a landscape around this particular foodstuff, that the food was the punchline to a story. It wasn't just a nice thing to eat. It was something that mattered to me.
So let's go with oysters. Tell us about the first time.
So it is worth knowing, I think, that my dear mother, Claire Rayner, was a well-known journalist, broadcaster, columnist. She was a sex advice columnist at Agniard, a sort of cross between Dr. Ruth and Dear Abby, very well-known. And once a year, each one of us siblings, the three kids, we would be treated as an only child and taken up to town to meet the rackety journalist that she worked for, who smoked and drank too much in the offices of Fleet Street. And once I'd met these charming people, I'd then be taken for lunch, proper lunch. And I was taken to a restaurant called Rules. It's the oldest restaurant in London. It's been there since 1798. And it serves all the good British food, none of the bad British food. And we were seated side by side on a red velvet banquette, which I'd never been seated. I'd never been seated like that before. For context, this will have been probably mid-late 70s, 76, 77. And a waiter comes along and says to Claire, "Will you be having the oysters this time?" And she looks at me expectantly. And the thing is, we have a rule in my family. You can't say you don't like something if you haven't tried it. And I've never tried oysters. And so I say, "Well, yes, I suppose we will." And then it begins. It's the theatre of the spindle frame and the plate with the muslin wrapped lemon and the bottle of Tabasco looking like something that ought to be applied to a wound rather than eaten. And I was just completely beguiled by the theatricality of this. Took absolutely took my breath away.
You talk about eating a Gulf oyster that was nearly a foot a foot long.
It was terrifying. So I, you know, although people know me as a restaurant critic, if they know me at all, I was an old, what we British call an old hack. I was an old reporter for a very long time. And I believe in, you know, shoe leather being worn down. So I traveled a lot looking for the greatest oysters. I went to Seattle and San Francisco, and then I went to New Orleans and then down to the misnamed Grand Isle, which isn't very grand and not really an isle. It's reached by a bridge. And I met this great Raging Cajun called Jules Melanson, who'd been fishing for oysters in the Gulf of Mexico for 30 years and had just started farming them. And he was very proud of this two-year-old oyster. You know, I must see this two-year-old oyster, which I found baffling because I'd only ever tried two-year-old, you know, oysters at least 2 years old. This one was literally a foot long. And when he prized off the shell, I had never seen anything like it. I posted a picture on Twitter, and the response was, is that a face hugger from Alien? Has somebody put your spleen in a shell? It was vast and terrifying. I couldn't eat the whole thing in one go. I did ask for it to be sliced up. It was fantastic, but very, very big.
Yeah, I mean, you could choke on it if you went.
What a way to go, Evan. What a way to go, choking on an oyster.
So you first ate oysters at 10.
Yeah.
But then you say that snails were your
gateway. It was earlier.
Were your gateway, where you were eating them from the garden as a toddler?
No, I wasn't. There was a restaurant in London, it's gone now, called Stone's Chop House. It opened as a coffee shop, as a coffee house in London in the late 18th century. And it was still there in the 1970s. My parents had an account there. It was one of those places where the waiters had never come across a foodstuff they couldn't set fire to tableside. They loved doing that. Apart from the snails, which they invited you to set fire to yourself, and they brought them on a burner, and you had tongs and all that sort of stuff. And according to my dear parents, they said, I got the hang of this very, very quickly. You have to understand, as a kid, as a boy, I was very bad at boy stuff. I was very bad at climbing trees or skimming stones, and always the last one to be picked for the team in football. But when you put me at the table, I could leapfrog all my peers, and suddenly I was a grown-up, an adult, and it mattered to me immensely.
So you mentioned fire in that first instance, and then you have another instance of fire and snails.
Well, yeah, I went on a school skiing trip to the Alps, the Swiss Alps, which was a terrible idea for a boy with fat thighs and weak ankles and no sense of balance. And I was very homesick. I really was. I was trudging back from the slopes one day with my skis over my shoulder when I noticed another hotel in it. It had a menu all in French, and I understood only one word, which tells you what kind of a privileged child I was, and the word was escargot. So I, having had dinner at the terrible hotel we were staying in, I went back and ordered the snails, and I was suddenly not homesick. I was at peace. I was frying little bits of bread in ponds of dairy fat above a guttering flame and getting really good at it. I went back 3 days in a row and kept turning the flame up until the whole thing burst into flames. It was, you know, sheets of flame 2 or 3 feet high. And all I remember is the waiter appearing next to me and throwing open the window and chucking the thing into the snow, not least because the hotel was entirely built of wood. It had survived for 150 years before young Mr. Rayner turned up with his snail habit.
You're so lucky that you managed to have this marriage of aesthetic understanding of food and means at such a young age.
Well, they weren't my means, were they? My parents had very meagre upbringings. They were working class Jews, brought up in the East End of London just before the Second World War and during. And they did well for themselves. My mother really was very, very successful and, you know, wrote many best-selling books and all of that. And I think they were determined that none of their privation should be visited on us. We were aware of what we had. We were aware of our good luck. My father wasn't particularly into restaurants. My mother was. As she became a freelance journalist and then a successful columnist, she saw it as a mark of having been welcomed into another part of society. And I think, to be honest, although I didn't start as that kind of journalist, as I really was covering murders and crime and politics, the restaurant world was something I had a long love for, and that did come from my parents.
I want to go back to your very first food memory of still warm boiled eggs mashed with pieces of buttered toast. Have you been chasing that exact amount of toastiness your whole life?
I don't know if I've actually been chasing it. I don't think I could recreate it. And curiously, I didn't attempt to recreate it for my kids, my own kids. But it's a very strong memory, and I think it's one that many people will have if they had a, you know, if they were, you know, had a happy and good relationship with their parents, of being that little bit of unwell where you are, you know, kept in bed as a very small child. I mean, honestly, I must have been 18 months or so. And it being a textural thing of the buttered toast and the softness of the egg and the richness of the yolk. And more importantly, and, you know, I don't want to be too queasily sort of sweet about it, the fact that it would have been my mother who was feeding it to me. It's one of those classic maternal memories. I am, you know, one of those stolid Englishmen who reacts a little strongly when people talk about things being cooked with love, because I'd much prefer them being cooked with technique and good taste. But obviously, emotion plays a very important part in the foods to which we have a great attachment.
So bread is definitely a part of this meal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And do you know the hilarious thing is, in our current culture, you know, writing a whole chapter celebrating bread and butter felt almost subversive, you know, given that gluten is the enemy. I'm a big fan of gluten, love gluten, and love bread and love sourdough. And going in search of sourdough, wandering the streets of San Francisco and being a spectator in its sourdough toast wars, which are, you know, raging across the city as everybody tries to see who can charge the most for a piece of toast. This probably is a, you know, presages the collapse of Western civilization as we know it, Evan, when people start obsessing over pieces of toast.
I've eaten those toasts. They're very good. We have similar toasts here in Los Angeles.
I'm sure. It's a good day out, isn't it? I mean, you know,
a really good day out.
It's a really good day out, yeah.
So I have a question for you. Who is making this meal?
Well, that was an interesting point. I had to, you know, I go off in pursuit of this. And I'm telling stories about myself and I hope pulling the threads together. And it became clear to me only towards the end that I actually did have to stage a Last Supper. There had to be an event or this story wouldn't sort of have its point. And it all came together when I was sitting with a very old friend, a chef called Henry Harris. He's a great classic French chef, by which I mean bistro French cooking. And he had started working for a group of pubs, and we were having lunch together, eating rabbit in mustard sauce, that sort of thing. And we started talking about a particular dessert, the Mont Blanc, which is meringue with cream and chestnut puree, which he'd always made. And it was his one that I was trying to recapture. And I suddenly thought, why don't I just get you to do it? He had a big room above his pub, a very lovely room. I could fit 40 people in. And that's what we did.
And what about the people that you're eating this last meal with? Are you eating it with people or would you be alone?
Oh, I wouldn't be alone. What's the point of that? I mean, I like myself. I honestly do. But it's all about the company. It's very interesting. Somebody asked me recently why the luxury ingredients hadn't appeared on my table. Why was there no Chateaubriand, no foie gras, whatever? And I said, because they drain the interest away. They make you focus on them. Whereas I think a good meal is not just about the dishes. It's about the people and the moment. And so when I staged it, it was some of my closest friends, my family, the musicians that I work with who are like family. And we had a high old time of it.
And I'm actually delighted that that meal that you had was not your last meal.
Well, no, actually, that's the point. I mean, I start off making the point that all the people who are eligible for last meals are the least suited to eating one. It's not a happy bunch. It's the condemned, the suicidal, and the terminal. Because it's not really what you're being asked, is it? You're being asked, if nobody was watching, if there were no consequences, then what would you have? And I feel a little bit like I have dealt with a key piece of gastronomic business.
That's Jay Rayner, restaurant critic for The Observer. The book is Jay Rayner's Last Supper, One Meal, A Lifetime in the Making. Let's head to the San Gabriel Valley, where the selection of food from different regions in China is one of the great joys of being an Angeleno. Bill Addison, one of the restaurant critics at the Los Angeles Times, is here to share a new entrant to the SGV's delicious landscape.
It's a good one. Hi, Evan.
Hi.
We're talking about Xiang Lahui in Alhambra. It is a Sichuan newcomer, and there is plenty of Sichuan food in the San Gabriel Valley and beyond, but this is something different. It's got a little angle that the owner is working.
So if it's Sichuan food, it's going to be compared to Chengdu Taste and Sichuan Impression.
Yes, the two standard bearers, absolutely. Then there are plenty of others, and there's a hot pot boom going on. But when we're talking about kind of more of a range of composed dishes, those are the two, Chengdu Taste and Sichuan Impression.
So let's start with this stew, this amazing, I mean, the photograph in the newspaper of this particular stew is just...
Yes. It's called Maozu Wang. It comes from Chongqing, from the southwestern China megacity, which became its own municipality in 1997, but is still tied in with the culinary traditions of the Sichuan province. So this is a stew. It's crimson, like so many of those great Sichuan dishes. And you dip in the ladle and all these different cuts of meat and seafood emerge. Ribbons of pork and beef and peeled shrimp and tripe. And there's even spam. There's even spam in there. Zhu in the Maozu Wang means blood. And there are cubes of jellied duck's blood in there as well. And it tastes like silken tofu. The story is that it was invented by a butcher's family, and they had all these different cuts of meats, and they dropped in the jellied duck's blood by accident to the stew. You know, I think a lot of those stories have this sort of like one element that kind of differentiates the dish, but that's what I read in Fuchsia Dunlap's great book, The Food of Sichuan.
So when looking at the food of this restaurant, is it a place that you go to just test how hot you can stand the food?
No, which is the beautiful thing, right? I think as Sichuan has emerged in Los Angeles and all over America, the favorite line of food writers is about how, yes, you can scorch your palate. It's fiery food. Often you have the ma la, the hot and numbing. But Sichuan food is also about nuance and, interestingly, about spice. And I mean like cardamom and cloves and cinnamon, all these sweet spices that sometimes can ripple underneath the chili flavor and add a whole new dimension. And a lot of that is going on in this food. Both owner Will Wang and his chef Ning Du are natives of Chongqing. And so that's the sensibility that they're bringing specifically to this place.
Could you speak to the cold dishes that Fuchsia tells us we should start with?
Yes.
To open our appetites?
Yeah, I love that. It's the cold dishes are the traditional way to start a meal. And there's a big, beautiful section of those dishes. So there might be sliced lotus root. There might be vinegary little enoki mushrooms, some potently garlicky cucumbers that definitely are ways that awaken the palate. Their fried pig's ear and chili oil. It does the job. It wakes you up.
And do we find dishes here that we find at other restaurants, like, for example, toothpick lamb?
So I think the toothpick lamb, which is cumin-scented and has a beautiful, like, halo of spice. You know, it's the kind of thing where it doesn't just thwack your taste buds. It sort of blooms on the palate, if that makes sense, to kind of differentiate that experience.
And what makes them so engaging is they're addictive. I mean, you think that you can't take another one, and then you find yourself with this pile of toothpicks next to your
like
plate.
Popcorn almost, like lamb popcorn. Yeah, it's particularly good here. And this is one dish that I would say for, you know, Sichuan obsessives, come here and compare this one to Chengdu Taste and Sichuan Impression. I think it's leading the pack right now.
And what about their fried chicken?
Also incredibly good. So we're talking about that dry walked style of fried chicken where they've marinated it in a lot of those spices that I talked about, the sweeter spices, and they drop it in with chilies, so you're sort of in this nest of fiery red chilies, and you're plucking out the boneless pieces of kind of breaded chicken. And it's the same thing. You get that sort of aura of heat without the actual, like, you know, flames, in a good way.
Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan. Let's all go to the San Gabriel Valley and eat there right now.
That's Bill Addison, restaurant critic for the LA Times. We've been chatting about his favorite dishes at Siang La Hue. How about a walk in the woods? One of my favorite foragers is in the studio next. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Humans love tinkering, and fermenting food is probably one of the oldest ways our ancestors played around with their environment. As we know from our love affair with sourdough breads, yeasts are everywhere, and putting them to good use to transform what we eat is a fascinating endeavor. But noted wild food researcher Pascal Baudard takes fermentation a step farther by using the technique with material he forages. Hi.
Bonjour.
It's always so great to check in with you and find out what crazy wild man experiments you've been doing.
It is a bit crazy in a good way.
In a good way. Everything is always so delicious. You've been on this adventure of exploring the natural world and creating delicious foodstuffs with foraged materials, what you call wildcrafting.
Right.
But what came first, your love of foraging or an appreciation for fermented foods?
The love of nature. That's really what came out first. And then a passion for the flavor that you cannot get anywhere else. What I call the true flavor of the land. It doesn't matter where it is, Belgium, I was in Scotland, you know. It's just the true flavor of the land.
So these days, so many of us have like stepped into the brine and played around with krauts and kimchi, but picking something wild might seem kind of edgy. So where do we start?
It's super easy. One of the most common plants that you find in the wild around here would be mustard. We are loaded with wild mustard. All the hills in May are turning yellow because of wild mustard. All invasive, by the way. Nobody's doing anything with it. It's from the Brassica family. It's a perfect candidate for fermentation. And because it's invasive, I like to use every single part of it, from roots to stems to leaves to flowers and to seeds, to make mustard.
So do you make like a mustard kraut?
Yes, I call that the mustard kraut. Mustard kraut, and it's basically like, you know, you can start very simple, and the book actually starts super simple with mixing like maybe 15% of mustard, and then you keep moving through the book, and you're going to get more and more extreme a little bit.
So the base is still cabbage at sort of this kind of 101 wild fermenting.
In the beginning of the book, we're going to start working with kimchi base, sauerkraut base. So we keep it simple. And it's kind of an invitation for the reader to start exploring bit, but by gradient. And all the plants that I use in the book are really the most common wild edible that you're going to find in your yards or close to nature. And I would say like 95% of them are what we consider weeds and invasive.
So can we make a dandelion kraut?
Totally.
And what kind of flavor does dandelion have once it's fermented? How does it transform?
See, dandelion is a little bit better if you do like a kimchi kind of things. I like to mix things together. So dandelion has a base of bitterness, but also earthy. So you mix that with different spice, a little bit of curry, a little bit of chili, a little bit of garlic. You can even add, you know, herb de Provence if you wanted to, or Italian herb. So you can really start experimenting and mix it, but you actually get flavor that you don't get anywhere else. I mean, dandelion is sold now, but, you know.
But it's still different than the kind we would pull out of our
yards. You're not going to find a dandelion kimchi or dandelion sauerkraut anywhere, that's for sure.
And when you use these plants, the mustard and the dandelion, for example, are we chopping up the whole thing or are we just using the leaves?
It really depends on the texture of the plant. For example, black mustard, which you find like, you know, over the hills in like Thousand Oaks and it's really covering everything over there. The leaves are okay. You can actually ferment the whole leaf. It's a little bit chewy, which is an interesting texture. We're not used to it anymore. If you don't like chewy, you can use a knife technique that we call chiffonade, where you cut it in like very fine layers. The one that we have locally where I live near Pasadena is the Mediterranean mustard. That one's a little bit more tough, but interesting broccoli flavor. And that one you will need to chop it a little bit.
So interesting. In the process of working on these recipes and walking through the forests and experimenting, were there some plants that were less successful?
Yes, nasturtium. My God, that was gross. I tried that one. I tried fermenting that one. I really, because I love the flavor. And man, when I fermented it, that was bad. Stinging nettle is another one. I wanted to do a paste, like a fermented paste of stinging nettle. And when I opened it, it was the sensation of falling headfirst into a cow pie. I remember that as a kid. It did happen to me. So I've done mistake. I mean, not mistake, like thing that didn't work. They're not in the book. But yes, that was interesting.
So every time you come to visit me, you bring me a tiny little precious jar of wild
mustard seeds.
Of wild mustard.
Yeah, Dijon, wild Dijon.
It is truly the best mustard I've ever tasted in my life, and I almost eat it just out of the jar, like quarter teaspoon by quarter teaspoon until it's gone. What makes that so special? Just the difference of the wild seed?
The difference of the wild. And I can tell you, I touch about it at the end of the book, but I'm also in a new journey a little bit, because the more I get experience of dealing with wild plant, the more I'm a little bit frustrated by the sense that all those wild plants are considered invasive and non-native, and they are not used whatsoever. They may be crop in different country, but here locally, we only look at them as weeds. And I tell you, if you take a look at the amount of wild food that is quote-unquote invasive, it's probably the biggest food waste in Los Angeles. Food waste is so, like, trendy right now, but nobody's looking at this. I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of acres of wild mustard. Nobody's doing anything with it. And you only have two solutions. It's always spraying chemicals, herbicides, or you do habitat restoration and you just throw away all the resource. And what I'm trying to do with this book and also with what I do is to look at environmental solution, like making food as part of the environmental solution for all those non-native and invasive. And that's kind of like my journey right now.
One of the things in your journey that I've been most fascinated about, and I've been lucky enough to taste them, and they're fantastic, are your plant-based cheeses.
Right.
And I remember when you first started this journey, I thought, this man is going to kill himself. But instead, you really have come up with something that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And really shows off the environment and the way you finish them.
Yes.
So could you describe a little bit about your process?
So it's basically lacto-fermented cheese, and you can make cheese with acorn, you can make cheese with all kinds of different walnuts that you find, including chestnuts. And the basic principle is super simple. You make a paste, and in order to make a paste, usually you add water in the Vitamix. You can use a stone grinder too, by the way. But instead of using water, I will use the juice of like a sauerkraut juice or brine or kimchi brine or whatever. And then I will grind my nuts, you know, make a paste out of it, and it will start fermenting automatically because I've introduced the lactobacteria in it. I make it a little bit too salty, which is good. The bacteria like salt too. And then I put them into a towel and put a weight on it so it squeezes out the excess juice. After 2 or 3 days of fermentation, I remove the cheese and then I shape it, and everything is about the crust. Like I always say, a good relationship is based on trust, and with the cheese, it's based on crust. I take wild herbs, I will take all kinds of leaves and all kinds of different stuff and create those really beautiful crust. That kind of represents what the cheese is all about. So they're very, very, very pretty, but they are also very, 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 very good. you know. And inside, you're going to put flavoring, like a little bit of cheese flavoring, so nutritional yeast, a little bit of miso maybe. I'm going to use herbs powder, wild seeds sometime, aromatic plant. It's kind of like each cheese is special. It's a little bit of a piece of art.
Another thing that I found really moving that you talk about in the book is when fires swept through the area that you used for foraging and for classes, for taking so many of your walks
right.
with students,
yeah.
and how you sat there and looked at this area that was just devastated.
Oh my God, yes, it was a desert. And then?
And then?
And then I say, well, what can I do? And I love it. I always look at, you know, I love challenges. Challenges make me, I, for whatever reason, they make me more creative. And I start looking at ashes. I'm like, well, I'm making cheese right now. Ashes are used by French, you know, on top of cheese to avoid mold. So I started foraging different ashes. And I collected ashes from oak trees, ashes from willow trees, and all kinds of different stuff. And started playing with it on my cheese.
But that log...
Oh, the log, fermenting in the log, too. I was also super interested. I had nothing beside ashes and logs, really, at that point. And they cut, you know, they were cutting different trees that were about to fall down, and there was this beautiful log, oak log. And I realized that, you know, in France and Belgium, we are going to age our wine or beer in, you know, oak barrels because of the flavors that the oak can impart. And I became fascinated. I'm like, why not fermenting in an oak barrel? So I created this oak barrel out of this branch, and I started fermenting in it. And my God, it was so different. You get this kind of like oaky flavor a little bit in a good way. I mean, I don't know. I think oak has like more than 150 compound, flavorful compound in it. You can taste the wood in a good way, and you can taste also the fire in a good way. You know, it was fascinating. I loved it.
Well, we love you, Pascal.
Thank you.
Pascal Baudard is a wild food researcher and instructor in traditional food preparation and techniques. His latest book is Wild Fermentation. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or in KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, and as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. I'm Evan Kleinman. Stay healthy, everybody, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.